From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming together today for this meeting. Look forward to a good discussion. Obviously, the five of us have met at this table in this room on a fair number of occasions so far this year.
But we haven't met here since last May. If we don't meet, how are we supposed to know how to reach a conclusion? What if I wanted to surrender to you? Where was I supposed to go?
The characterization that there's not communication going on is dead wrong. It has been going on. The problem we experience is when there is a meeting, at least the speaker says nothing. The Senate president talks a lot, and some of what he says is different out here than in there.
Well, that's an interesting point. In my response there is to say that I learned a long time ago that when you talk, you don't learn. And my purpose today was to listen to learn.
From 2003 to 2015, every spending plan for 12 years was Democrat proposed. Democrat passed, Democrat signed.
Speeches like that, where I totally disagree with most of what you just said, is not helpful in the negotiating process, okay? I can't speak for the last 12 years. I've been the Senate president for 7.5.
Those are the governor and legislative leaders of Illinois as the long-awaited budget meeting takes place. We'll talk about that and their agreement to meet again, we guess, and the mayor of Chicago fires his top cop. All on State Week, I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Brian Mackey, reporter for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio at the state capitol, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, and in Chicago, joining us over the phone is Mark Brown of the Chicago Sun-Times. Mark, thanks for taking some time out for us this week.
Glad to join in.
And so we have a legislative leaders meeting. We got to hear all of them making some comments that seemed a little like sniping, no big statements. Amanda Venicky, what did we come away with?
We came away with really a whole bunch of nothing. It seemed as if, for the most part, the leaders repeated the same old stances that we've been hearing all year long. The one real change that you saw was that it seems as if there is going to be another meeting early next week in Chicago. So that at least is, I think, in many people's eyes, some sort of progress. But perhaps it's one of those two steps forward, two steps back scenarios, because following the meeting, you heard from the Republican leaders there, and then who said, hey, Senate President John Cullerton, they really took a sort of lashing to him, and he, of course, didn't really appreciate that. So whatever went on behind those closed doors, we can't quite be sure, but it seems as if Republicans weren't pleased with it, and then the Senate president not pleased that they took that airing of grievances, we'll say, for the season public.
And Mark Brown, you got to view these festivities. You're without a Festivus take necessarily. Your views on what happened?
Well, you know, I think most of us had low expectations going in, simply because, you know, when it started off to be a public negotiation, what good's going to come of a public negotiation? And what you feared would be that they would make speeches and, you know, to try to justify their positions. And, you know, that's what ended up happening. And you know, I don't know if there was a hardening of positions or not. I can't really say that because I think they're probably pretty hardened going in there. But, you know, it's discouraging for people who want to see a solution here, I thought.
It, you know, during the comments, I had observed very much that you did have Speaker Madigan, for example, directly commenting toward the governor, saying, "Governor, your position." And then right back, I had characterized it as almost a lawyer sounding like a rebuttal when Governor Rauner said continually, Speaker Madigan, you say this. Speaker Madigan, you say this. So for anybody that was just tuning in, we haven't seen numbers. I'm not sure how many people watched because this was, of course, you know, live streamed and there was a lot of anticipation for this meeting, although there was, for those who follow it closely, as Mark said, not a lot of expectation, perhaps, that anything would get done. But you could see very much the lines in the sand that have been drawn just from those public remarks there. What went on, again, behind closed doors, I think it's telling that the meeting, that portion at least, lasted less than an hour. And part of that, the leader said, was because they didn't have any staff there. It was really just the four legislative leaders and the governor. And in the future, to get things done, they need people that can really crunch the numbers and are more area experts. They supposedly talked a lot about workers' compensation. That was something that perhaps there could be movement on. And as we've talked about on this program, there might be an opportunity. You know, term limits, is the speaker ever going to agree to that? Probably not. But workers' compensation, both sides have said there is some room. It just depends on how much each is willing to give.
I'd like to speak out in defense of the public aspect of the meeting, at least as a concept. I think when the good government, reform groups, whatever you want to call them, that urged this meeting to take place, floated that idea that it should be public, there was this fantasy out there that, well, the governor has one position and he's refusing to budge. The Democrats, you know, say they're absolutely not going to go along with certain aspects of the governor's proposal that would target and undermine the strength of labor unions, which are a key Democratic base of support. And you kind of hope that governor would say, we need to do this, and the Democrats would say no. And then you'd hear what happens next. And we've never really heard anybody say, okay, well, I'll back down a little. And nobody wants to back down. Nobody wants to blink. And you know, you have this sense that it's just like two children, mine, 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 mine. And nobody is really moving in the least. And so you had this fantasy, well, maybe if they're on camera and it's like a panel discussion, you know, somebody's going to have to say something. Except when the governor, you know, floated the rules, he kind of took the ball away from these good government groups and said, okay, I'll set the terms. And it was much more like a political debate. Okay, you'll have 10 minutes, you'll have 10 minutes. Interestingly, the governor's the only one who took up the full 10 minutes. The Democrats kept their remarks very short. I think the Dems spoke for about 8 or 9 minutes total. And then the Republicans took up the other 24, 25 minutes of that opening statements. And, you know, then the cameras got shut off.
I wish it was like a real debate. Can you imagine there a moderator and kind of one of these where somebody speaks, somebody else actually jumps in instead of this formulaic 10 minutes you get to talk? That would be interesting. Maybe then we'd get something accomplished.
Now, I did hear Speaker Madigan say in some post-meeting remarks he was there to learn. What did he learn?
We don't know because he didn't talk about it. I mean, I think that's when you're there to learn, or when you're there to listen and then learn, it helps if you then express what you're learning.
Well, and that was one of the sources of frustration that Senate Republican leader Christine Rodonio came out. She said that we have one guy who talks too much, John Cullerton. And as I said, I don't think he really appreciated that. And then she said we have a speaker who doesn't speak. And that was the only response that Mike Madigan gave when asked, hey, why is it that you don't talk during these meetings, that he's there to learn? And of course, many an individual had to raise their eyebrows at that, because whereas Madigan has a reputation for being very studious and careful about his every step, this is a guy who's been around longer than all the rest and presumably knows pretty darn well where he stands on each of these issues. And maybe he's learning still about Bruce Rauner and vice versa. But nonetheless, people are very much waiting on him to make a next move. And so that's where I guess these public, be it the speech before the meeting or the after the fact question and answers with the media, are sometimes revelatory, and even if it isn't new or news, but you do see how very intractable this perhaps is when you're in those meetings and you have a speaker who isn't speaking.
Well, do you think it's possible that Madigan's intent was to see whether or not Republicans were willing to move on some of those issues that you alluded to, workers' compensation? I've said all along that that is an area that both sides can probably work out a deal, just as happened with the unemployment insurance changes that were approved by the House earlier. It was business and labor sitting down and coming to some agreement that's going to save businesses money, and it's a step forward. I think they could do the same thing on workers' compensation. If the governor would focus on those kinds of issues instead of what I consider the quest for these constitutional amendments, I fail to see how those constitutional amendments are relevant to today's situation. And as I've told other people, were I a reporter asking the governor, I would say, could you explain to me, I'm assuming you've actually read the language of these resolutions, can you explain to me the significance in 2015 for the 2016 budget of a term limits amendment that will take effect practically in 2027, or a redistricting amendment that will see the impact in 2023? That's a pretty long lead time, whereas with workers' compensation, you could make changes that a prospective investor in Illinois putting a plant here would say, I can see how this benefits me immediately. I don't have to wait a decade to find out whether or not some guy in the legislature I don't like is going to get kicked out by term limits.
Well, the governor has said that this is his biggest point of leverage, right? He said that I think he views that from his standpoint, these are changes that he thinks Illinois needs to make for its long-term health. And I think as we're seeing old people, elderly and impoverished people not able to get the heating assistance they need this winter, and people with developmental disabilities, you know, being shut out of services and other things like changes like that happening around Illinois, I think the governor is hoping that Democrats will, you know, sort of say, okay, we'll you know, take the long-term pain of selling out labor and you know, in order to get these social services and social programs funded now. And, you know, as he said in the past, you need leverage. And I think this is what he views as his best point of leverage to make those long-term changes that people would not agree to otherwise.
We look ahead. They said they're meeting next week. What do we know as we record this midday on Friday? What are specifics, if any, do we know about that meeting?
Just that it's expected to be in Chicago. The governor said, you know, he pushed for it to be in Springfield. He is really making a point to be a resident of the governor's mansion after criticism at Blagojevich and Quinn for not actually living in the capital city. He said he wanted it here, but others disagreed. And of course, you do have all four of the legislative leaders from Chicago or the suburban area and those Republicans. So we know it's in Chicago, and that's about all. Don't know what's on the agenda, how long it'll be, or what they'll actually discuss.
From your perch, Mark Brown, what do you see happening? Do you see something developing in the near future and some agreements breaking and the crack in the ice?
Well, not really. I think Carlton came right out and said it this week, that even if you had a deal, You wouldn't try to move it until after the first of the year when you have the lower vote threshold. And my, from whatever I've witnessed of the legislative process, you can never do a deal a month in advance and expect it to like hold. So, you know, I don't think, you know, there'll be any major progress. But, you know, I did feel like, you know, there did seem to be a door open on the workman's comp, and it's although really neither the speaker or the governor have seemed willing to move off of where they are on that, and you know, but that, as Charlie says, has always seemed like a fruitful area, although. You compared it, Charlie, to the unemployment insurance changes, which I think when really if you looked at it, even though, you know, they talked it up, there really wasn't anything really major there. But it, you know, you could do something and say you got something done.
Well, but with the UI, they're going to save, I forget the number, but it's in the tens of millions of dollars that they're saving the business community, unless I misread the statement from Mark Densler, the the head of the Manufacturers Association that was praising it.
Right. I mean, it's one of those things where it's not the most major of deals in a broader perspective, but to the communities that were part of it, yeah, it is a big deal. And it took some trust. The labor community says it's still hesitant about some of the changes dealing with misconduct and the unemployment insurance program. But where they say it's different is, first of all, I mean, I took a look at this deal because there's two things. First of all, there was a pretty much dead set drop date. And when it comes to the budget, we've obviously long surpassed that. But for unemployment insurance, they were up against things that were going to be bad for both sides at the start of the new year. And so there was that component. And then secondly, they said that they both had something to win. So I've kind of thought of it as, you know, in that regard, there was a carrot and a stick. But when it comes to this, labor looks at, for example, what the governor wants, or Democrats when it comes to look at what the governor is asking for. And there's no reason for them to agree to it because they don't like any of it. There's nothing good from their perspective that they could get out of agreeing with him.
Well, but I would argue that if we can get away from this destroying collective bargaining, then maybe, and I say this, I'm proud to say I'm a lifetime member of the Chicago Newspaper Guild. My father helped organize it at the Sun-Times, good grief, like 70 years ago. I think giving a little bit on workers' compensation or maybe on the personal injury lawsuit area in return for removing this threat to collective bargaining that's the governor is mounting and freeing the hostages that the governor has taken, the people in need, the people who are suffering from the lack of a budget. I think I would argue that that's what's in it for me. I'm making the best of a bad situation.
I'm just not sure the governor is prepared to give up on those things, though. He's been very tight-lipped about the whole union thing, particularly during the general election campaign, right? It was government union bosses when he was running in the Republican primary, and then he didn't say much about it during the general election campaign, and he's talked about it again since taking office. But if you go back a few years and listen to some of his statements, particularly when it comes to government unions like AFSCME and SEIU, I mean, he would openly call it AFSCAMMY. At public events. It appears from his past statements that he has a sort of deep-seated antipathy towards the very notion of government unions. And that may be where his red line is, right? That could be something that he feels he cannot back down on. And if that's the case, maybe we're going to have to go 4 years with just court-ordered spending and no appropriations in Illinois. I don't know.
Well, what happens if after the first of the year, one of our major public universities, and it won't be the U of I because we have all kinds of resources. We're a world-class institution. We have all kinds of research money coming in. We skim off the top for administrative expenses. But what happens if, for example, Northern Illinois University, Mark's alma mater, says, sorry, guys, but we're going to have to not offer these classes anymore because we have no money. And you guys, you students who we floated the MAP grants for in the fall, we can't do that in the spring. And so what happens if suddenly there are a lot of suburban families who realize their kids can't go back to college? Isn't that pressure, I would wonder, on suburban lawmakers, most of them Republican? And then don't they in turn tell the governor, it's great that you have this ideological hatred of unions, but it's getting in the way of your showing yourself to be an effective governor?
I think that could be very much the big next pressure point, and when we see changes. And I mean, I don't know how that will pan out. Of course, nobody does, but you've got to expect that the Rauner administration is looking at that. They had wanted some administrative changes, and I think operate under the belief that there's too much spending going to universities when the governor has been asked about this. He says he supports education fully, and especially community colleges, which also haven't received state funding, as well as higher ed. He hasn't really had a direct response to that, but certainly that's looming. And again, will it be that universities are truly in that situation? Are they going to be able to shuffle through another semester, perhaps with fewer classes, with some of these smaller schools, as you noted? We're not talking all of the public universities, but they've so far tried to really be careful. They don't want to scare students. And further, they've got to work with the administration and legislators. So they're really trying to, I think, pivot around this when you look at higher ed. But that could be maybe what does force a deal.
Yeah, and I'm not saying necessarily that the university presidents are going to descend on the governor's mansion. I think it
will
come from the grassroots.
I haven't seen much spine in my entire years of covering higher education in university administrators across the state or nation.
I think, as we were saying, and Amanda, you're right, it's a pressure point when suddenly this impasse is no longer affecting low-income people who are not getting heating assistance, although we pass money for that, or elderly people who no longer have assistance so they can live at home. But when it's fairly well-to-do folks living in the burbs and suddenly they can't, their child is not going to be able to go to school because of these kinds of cuts, and they tell their legislators, that's to me where the pressure comes from.
Well, I did see something this week. I saw in that Western Illinois University has announced an early retirement program. And I think that's the first time I've seen just an individual state agency, so to speak, doing that. And they are going to pay people if they retire by the first of the year and meet the ordinary retirement qualifications. They are going to pay them 25% of next year's salary. So they're going to be paying out a bonus that hasn't been done anywhere else. So that's the first university I've seen doing this. Maybe others have announced it, but some of those things that happen at a Western or Eastern, we don't always pick up on.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about pressure points. So we had these little pressure points last week for the House to take care of road salt, lottery winners, fixing roads a little bit, or at least handing out the tax money for roads. What is the pressure point? Charlie gave his pressure point of higher ed. Mark Brown, what do you think is a higher ed pressure point that would bring them to take care of that piece of a piecemeal budget?
No, I've been writing about the MAP grants, but again, there isn't anybody besides some student groups really organizing that. And I find when I went out and tried to put my finger on that, it proved squishy in the terms of, you know, the schools don't want to stick up for themselves, and the students, you know, by and large, don't even, you talk to students, they don't really even understand what grants they have. They don't know if they have a MAP grant or if it's Pell. It's just a lot of them aren't even sure with, you know, how their funding packages are put together. So I think that'll be the first point here, but I don't know how quickly it's going to come together. And I'm always looking for the next one, and I haven't found it yet.
Well, Mark, you remember a couple of years ago, because you wrote about it at the time, when the General Assembly only approved enough money to cover grants for the fall semester, and the Student Assistance Commission said, well, we don't have enough MAP money for the full year. We're just going to give the grants out in the fall. There won't be any in the spring. And campuses around the state organized. Student leaders descended on the General Assembly, and lawmakers appropriated MAP money for the second semester. Now, they didn't come up with any way to pay for it. It was just added to the stack of IOUs, but the spending authority was there. And it was as students suddenly realized, hey, this is something that's going to really affect me, they mobilized themselves. Do you think that might happen this time around?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I hope it does. I like anything that, like, kind of puts this, you know, I really just don't think that the general public in Illinois is like still paying attention to this. I mean, we sort of can get certain groups aware, you know, as we've gone along here with the daycare money or the, you know, some of the special ed developmentally disabled groups. We can kind of get some focus from time to time, but then it just sort of peters away. Not, you know, we need money into the mental health community here. We got big problems there, but they don't seem to be able to get much of an organization going. So,
it's been so many years of this, but particularly this year of kind of crisis after crisis uprising from one group after the other, that's where I think it's become difficult. You say you don't have a budget, but then there are just these pockets that aren't getting funded. But we've heard so much of that. It's been trying on legislators, I think, and on the public. You know, to say cry wolf is wrong because there is some actual reason for the cries. And yet, I think that it can be difficult for somebody who isn't following this that closely to make sense of that all, because there's just such a very constant drumbeat as the situation evolves.
I want to move on to another topic real fast, just in the remaining time, since we have Mark on the show. Mark, there's been a lot of publicity in Chicago involving the police department there since the release of the shooting video up there. And the mayor fired the police superintendent. A lot of people are asking for the mayor's head. Is there really any danger for the mayor right now?
Well, there's plenty of danger for the mayor, and we've seen him sort of stumble over quite a bit of it here. But there's, I don't see any danger for him as far as, you know, that he's got to resign or something like that. I mean, this is a very serious problem in the police department, and this particular case is very problematic, and there are people who want to make it out to be him having tried to cover things up. I certainly don't think he was in any hurry for this information to come out. But again, the videos are what's really churning things right now. And you know, there never has been a policy of releasing these videos. And you know, you can sort of understand why. I mean, people do have you know, rights in an investigation that you don't put all the evidence out there. But since the investigation dragged on too long, now it looks suspicious. So, you know, he's just got a heck of a mess. And then he decided people started calling for to bring the Justice Department in to take a more systemic look at the police department. And he said, well, he didn't want to do that. And then, that started with Attorney General Lisa Madigan, and then Hillary Clinton jumped on, and then he had to backpedal here yesterday. So, I mean, he stepped in it again. He was trying to get out in front of the issue by firing McCarthy, and then he's right behind it again. So he needs to get a lot of things done, even in Springfield, right? And to be fighting this at the same time, there's a lot of danger for him.
And that's where we have to stop for this week. Thanks to Mark Brown of the Chicago Sun-Times for joining us, our guest on this edition of State Week. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org. Production assistance for our program today was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.